Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet photographer Jay Fleming, who is just finishing up a book about the waters of the Chesapeake. We'll hear about the early days of baseball on Delmarva, and naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about bug-safe summer hiking in places like Centerville's Millstream Trail. Photographer Jay Fleming has a particular passion for the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, including everything above and below the waterline, as well as the people who make their living off its bounty. He's finishing up a major project, publishing a book of over 300 of his photographs.
So Working the Water was a project that started 3 years ago. I first went out with Art Daniels. He's a waterman out of Deal Island. He's actually 94 this year. He just retired last year. But Art Daniels welcomed me aboard as Skipjack, the city of Crisfield, which he's worked for over 60 years. And Art's just an amazing guy, a truly inspirational person. And Art kind of inspired me to start on this project because through Art, I was able to realize, you know, how many people depended upon the industry, on the seafood industry, that is, and also, you know, that the industry was changing. And, you know, it was really important to document photographically guys like Art because they're living legends and, you know, they'll never be replaced. And they've seen things on the Chesapeake Bay that nobody else will ever see. The writing aspect of the book was difficult to sit down and find the time to write everything that I needed to write, but I felt like it was really necessary to kind of help describe the pictures, because there was only so much that we could include as far as the images went, and you really have to use writing in the captions, and we have a lot of section introductions that we call them. We have 31 different subchapters and 4 chapters to the book, and each subchapter has about 2,000 words. So I guess you could say I'm passionate about the topics that I cover. I have a passion for learning more about what I'm covering and better understanding it and helping other people better understand what I'm shooting, because there's a lot of what I'm shooting hasn't recently been covered. It's been years since somebody's done a visual narrative of the Chesapeake Bay and the seafood industry. And I think, even when they were done, they didn't really cover every fishery in detail. So I think, you know, my book is not only visually appealing, but it's very educational, because there's a lot of things covered in the book that a lot of people are unaware of. And I was out on Tangier Island earlier this week, and I brought the blue line proofs from my book out there. And I was showing it to some of the watermen I'm friends with out there. And some of them were, you know, they were learning stuff about different fisheries in the bay that they didn't know about, like snapping turtles. There's a lot of, it's a 280-page book, so there's a lot of pictures, and I wrote about 15,000 words for the book, too, based upon my experiences. So it's a lot of information as well.
Jay is becoming as well known for his underwater photography as his above water pictures. He knows his camera. He's able to capture just what he is seeing in pristine light and detail. His experienced eye prevents the need for a lot of retouching or processing of his imagery, whether using still photography or video.
I think a little bit of retouching on an image is necessary, like cropping a picture. If there's some distracting, like branch or, just something in the way of the focal point that takes away from what you're looking at, then I'll crop it if necessary. I'll adjust, the lighting, fill in some shadows, that type of stuff. But I really try to, use the light as my kind of natural retouching tool, so I don't have to go back in and really work on the image. Sometimes it's necessary, if you're just forced to shoot in bad light, like in the middle of the day, say somebody's wearing a hat and there's a shadow, casting down on their face and you can't see their face. Well, that's, that might require a little bit of work, but, as far as my post-production work goes, it's pretty minimal. I did start my photography in the darkroom, but quickly realized that I wanted to shoot in color. I really don't do any black and white. Occasionally I'll convert an image to black and white if it really needs it. And, you know, I try to incorporate color into every one of my photographs. So I really don't feel like my images translate very well to black and white, because that's kind of, you know, I'm going for the vibrant colors and, you know, the beautiful light in the morning and in the evening when I'm shooting outdoors. I think video has its place and still photography has its place. They're two completely different, you know, forms of art. I've recently branched off into video and started doing a little bit of video, and it's been a real effective tool for me to promote my still photography, and you know, it's been an effective storytelling tool as well. And it'll never replace photography, but it'll always be a supplemental tool to help, you know, tell the stories that I want to tell.
Jay has several degrees, one in economics from St. Mary's College and two others in natural resources and ecosystem conservation. His education gives him an informed appreciation and understanding of his subject matter. He learned photographic technique from his father, acclaimed Delaware photographer Kevin Fleming. Though he's still relatively young, his own artistry comes from personal experimentation over many years.
For me, composition was, learning composition was just a matter of trial and error. You know, just shooting a lot. I would, you know, I always try to go out 3 times a week to shoot pictures. Sometimes I don't get out that much, like when I was working on the book. But, you know, just shooting as much as possible has been the greatest teaching practice for me.
Jay's photography has the beauty of fine art, but his approach is that of a witness to the changing world around him.
I would say that, you know, I would consider myself more of a naturalist than an environmentalist. You know, I really, you know, try to look for stuff, you know, try to understand the ways that the environment works, rather than trying to, you know, push my agenda or my opinion. I really just strive to create like a accurate depiction of what's going on in the environment through my photographs. And you know, how people interpret them is up to them. I'm not trying to change any opinions through my photography or, you know, make any opinions for myself, but I would consider myself more of a naturalist.
Jay accepts commercial photography commissions. Much of this work has been for marketing materials for seafood companies. His book, Working the Water, will be released to the public this fall. Visit our website for a link to his site and social media accounts to find out about book signings and other associated events when they happen. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. Let's take a short break, but stay tuned because when we come back, we're talking baseball. Delmarva baseball history, that is. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back. I'm so glad you've joined us for the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. Now for a story about the early days of baseball on Delmarva. It has long been debated whether the rules in the creation of the first baseball diamond were by Alexander Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York. Regardless, all over the U.S., baseball leagues sprung up in big cities and little towns alike. It was clear that it was becoming part of the American way of life following the Civil War when the first professional leagues were formed. The appetite for baseball seemed unquenchable, even though these leagues had a lot of problems. They often lasted just a few years and then disbanded to be replaced by new ones. Most were run by volunteers with regular day jobs, and their budgets were always on a shoestring. Here on the Eastern Shore, teams were made up of mostly farm and cannery workers, the two largest industries here at the time. Records show that games were being played in Talbot County in 1866, and that within a year, Easton, St. Michael's, and Trapp had all organized teams. Chestertown had also caught baseball fever by this time. The post-Civil War boom economy, which led to rail lines being completed here on Delmarva, made travel easier for teams to play in a wider circuit of towns. Players were treated like celebrities in every town they visited. They were given parades and special meals in their honor with speeches and music. For overnight trips, they were often hosted in private homes because they couldn't afford to stay in hotels. In the earliest days, even if they were considered professionals, a player considered it high pay if they got $5 a game. Nonetheless, competition to join a team became very stiff. By 1908, the Cambridge Canners had to go through hundreds of applications to fill a 15-slot roster. From the late 1800s on, baseball was an obsession on Delmarva. World War I interrupted the usual summer fun, but once it was over, professional baseball became a serious business. And the Eastern Shore League was first formed in 1922. They managed to stay in business for 6 years with six teams, with all three states on the peninsula represented. From Maryland, there were the Cambridge Canners, the Crisfield Crabbers, the Pocomoke City Salamanders, and the Salisbury Indians. Delaware had the Laurel Blue Hens, and from Virginia came the Parksley Spuds. June 12th was opening day for the first season. 6,000 people attended the first game, and Delmarva fans felt like they were in baseball heaven. Unfortunately, with emotions running so high, spectators got out of hand during a game between Crisfield and Parksley. They attacked an umpire for a questionable call, sending him to the hospital with a cracked skull. The season was also marred by the practice of bringing in ringers mid-season from outside the area to improve a team's playoff chances. This was banned in the rules the next year. The new regulation and favorable notice from the big leagues led to athletes from other regions applying for regular positions on our local teams. Famed right fielder and Hall of Famer George Selkirk came all the way from Ontario, Canada, to play for the Cambridge Canners in 1927. There are many star players who grew up right here on Delmarva and who deserve a mention in this story, but there are three Hall of Famers in particular who stand out. The first is Frank Home Run Baker. He was born and raised in Trapp, Maryland. No matter where he played in the outfield or infield, he never really stood out as an asset for his team. His talent was hitting. He went up to the Major League in 1908 and hit a grand slam the very first time he stepped up to plate. He helped the Philadelphia A's win World Series titles in 1910, 1911, and 1913. Rival Yankees manager Hal Chase said that he was, quote, a dangerous man at all times, unquote. Throughout Frank Baker's baseball career, he was known to be a shy man who never had a bad word for anyone. After retiring from active play, he came back to Trapp to live and to scout area teams for the Philadelphia A's. That's when he found the next standout player in our story. Jimmy Fox got his start right out of high school when he was recruited to play for the Easton Farmers. His father, Del, was well known to baseball fans on Delmarva. He could have gone on to bigger things, but stayed on the Eastern Shore to help his family when his own father died suddenly. Jimmy played catcher for the Dover Senators in 1923. His team lost the local pennant to the Parksley Spuds, but they invited him to join them. In the 1924 playoff season, in a five-state series, they won the championship with his help. Frank Baker spotted this talented young man and recruited Jimmy to play for the Phillies, where he became one of the greatest first basemen of all time. In 1925, Fox was only 17 when he went to Fort Myers for his first spring training season. He went on to play for the Boston Red Sox and Chicago Cubs. He won three MVP awards and was featured on the cover of Time magazine. He earned the nicknames of Sudlersville Slugger and Double X, since his name Fox ended with two X's. Jimmy generally had a good relationship with his fans. He once visited a young boy who admired him who was in the hospital sick with tuberculosis. This may sound like a pretty standard thing that celebrities do, but in those days TB was a big deal and considered to be very contagious. Jimmy tried to follow in the footsteps of idols like Babe Ruth, but keeping up with their high living got the best of him. Jimmy was never able to handle his liquor or his money. And like so many other giant talents before and after him, he waited too long to hang up his hat. This made it hard for him to find work when he finally did. Not long before his premature death at the age of 56, Convinced his fame was no longer of any value, he gave away all his awards and memorabilia. On a somewhat sudden impulse, he gave them to Gil Dunn, a fan who had a small shrine dedicated to him in his Sudlersville pharmacy. This trove is now available for baseball lovers to view at the Sudlersville Train Museum. The town also has a statue of Jimmy. And his fame was apparently valuable to Hollywood. The character that Tom Hanks plays in the film A League of Their Own, about the Women's Baseball League during World War II, is based in part on stories about Jimmy Fox.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
Crying may be frowned upon in baseball, but people do get very emotional about this sport. Obsession for the game led most American towns to create and maintain beautiful ball fields for white players and fans. Until the mid-20th century, baseball, like everything else here, was segregated. The black community had to come up with their own ball fields, and because they had less money, these were usually empty lots or what they simply called clean places, with few amenities. The Eastern Shore Negro League was not formally recognized until 1932. Clearly, devotion to the game was just as strong for blacks as it was for whites. And you can't keep real talent down. That brings us to another local Hall of Famer. The story of baseball on Delmarva would not be complete without talking about William Judy Johnson. Judy was born in Snow Hill, Maryland in 1899. At about the age of 10, his family moved to Wilmington, Delaware to find better job opportunities. His father became the athletic director of the Negro Settlement House there. He was a boxing coach, but Judy had a passion for baseball from an early age. He began playing professionally for the Negro League in 1918. He was a power hitter with a consistently high batting average, and he was an excellent third baseman known to approach that position scientifically with, quote, intelligence and grace, unquote. By the 1920s, many white minor league rookies were starting at $150 a week. Black players were still making about $5 a game. So while he was still a player, Judy gladly became a team manager for the extra money. When Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, Judy had retired from active play and had been coaching in the Negro League for some time. Connie Mack, of Phillies fame, invited him to scout for the team. Judy is in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the Delaware Sports Hall of Fame. His home in Marshalltown, Delaware, is on the National Register of Historic Places. And you can also see a display dedicated to him at the Julia Purnell Museum in his birthplace, Snow Hill. Today, on any given day or evening from spring through early fall, you can catch a live game of baseball here on Delmarva. From boys and girls t-ball to little league, to high school and college ball, to recreation leagues, to the minor league Delmarva Shorebirds and the Wilmington Blue Hens. And though it's not considered the same game, don't discount baseball's exciting close cousins, slow and fast-pitch softball, which both women and men play. Hitting a ball and running the bases is a part of the fabric of our country. To watch a game on a small field where you can hear the players and coaches talking is very different and, in my opinion, more exciting than watching on TV or in a large stadium. Though some teams may play dirty and umps can make bad calls, it always feels good to root for your home team. But when your team loses, buck up and remember,
there's no crying in baseball!
Find out more about Delmarva's baseball heritage by visiting the Eastern Shore Baseball League Museum at Shorebird Stadium in Salisbury. It's open during their regular games. There are also a number of good books on this topic. Find links to these and more on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On August 15, 1919, floods in Caroline County broke dams, swept away bridges, damaged roads, homes, and crops. A little over 100 years earlier, on August 13, 1813, in the Battle of Slippery Hill, the Queen Anne's County militia skirmished with British troops near what is now the intersection of Route 18 and Bennett Point. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about hiking in places like Centerville's Millstream Trail.
There are many physical and psychological benefits that come from a good hike in the forest. You don't need to be an Appalachian Trail thru-hiker to reap the rewards from a short walk in the woods. For the body, short walks are medically proven to increase the fitness of your heart, lungs, and muscles, lower the risks of disease, such as type 2 diabetes and breast cancer, and burn more than 350 calories per hour. For the mind, hiking provides calming relief from the day-to-day stress of work, school, and home. A walk in the cool summer woods, even a short one, will help put your mind at peace as you begin to focus on the sounds of nature or your own footsteps. Even breathing the air around trees has health benefits. Trees secrete chemicals known as phytoncides that have been linked with reducing anxiety and improving immune defense. Simply put, walking in the woods makes us healthy and happy. Those of us who live and vacation here are fortunate to have miles and miles of forest hiking trails on the Delmarva Peninsula. One of Delmarva's great short hikes can be found in historic Centerville, Maryland, about 18 miles northeast of the Bay Bridge in Queen Anne's County. The one-mile Millstream Trail runs through woods and wetlands along the Corsica River from Millstream Park at the south end of Liberty Street to Doc's Riverside Grill off Chesterfield Avenue. Millstream Park was once the local spur of the Queen Anne's Railroad Company, which transported goods and passengers between Denton and Queenstown. The park features restrooms, a playground and pavilion, and access to the Millstream Trail. The paved pathways and bridges are safe for hikers and trail runners and accessible for wheelchairs. The trail is teeming with wildlife, and you may encounter bald eagles, ospreys, great blue herons, beavers, and river otters on your hike. The trail also connects you to the history of Centerville and the Chesapeake. The town has served as the center of commerce and government for Queen Anne's County for more than 220 years. Incorporated in 1794, Centerville was founded at the headwaters of the Corsica River, which provides easy access to the Chester River and Chesapeake Bay. During the 18th century, tobacco was shipped from Centerville's wharf to merchants in England. In the Revolutionary War, wheat and cattle were shipped through Centerville to supply the American rebel army. During the steamboat era, agricultural supplies, Chesapeake Bay tourists, and even circus elephants passed through Centerville's wharf. The town boasts several historic structures near the wharf, including four identical boat captains' houses and Maryland's oldest continually occupied county courthouse. The wharf provides a scenic stop along your trail hike before you walk back through the forest to Millstream Park. While the benefits of short hikes through Delmarva's forests are many, there are a few risks that you may encounter during a summer hike. If you're not prepared, you may leave the forest with hitchhiking pests that can make you seriously uncomfortable or seriously sick. But don't let that stop you from a healthy hike. Let's learn a little about these annoying invertebrates and a few tips for what we can do to keep them in the forest and off of us. Ticks are tiny, flat, blood-sucking parasites that are more closely related to spiders than to insects. They cling to low forest plants, waiting to hitch a ride on animals, including humans, that brush against them. Ticks begin their lives in a tiny egg and pass through a larvae and nymph phase before becoming a breeding adult. During both pre-adult phases, ticks are smaller than a pinhead. The adult deer tick, also known as the black-legged tick, is smaller than the dog tick. The deer tick is the common carrier of Lyme disease on Delmarva. Lyme disease is caused by bacteria transmitted through the bite of an infected deer tick. The deer tick takes 2 years to become an adult. In the spring, females lay thousands of eggs, and the tiny larvae hatch in late summer. The larvae live on the forest floor, waiting to feed on the first host, which is usually a mouse or another small mammal. If the host is infected with Lyme disease, tick larvae become infected during feeding. Ticks only feed once during each stage of life, and they usually require several days of blood sucking before they swell up, detach from their host, and fall to the ground to molt to the next stage. after the transition from the ground-dwelling larval stage, the tick nymph will climb higher in the forest vegetation to search for larger hosts such as squirrels, raccoons, deer, and, unfortunately for us forest hikers, humans. Tick nymphs are active during spring and summer, which is the time when most of us are enjoying our walks in the woods. Most human Lyme disease cases are probably the result of bites from deer tick nymphs. After the nymph has fed on the blood of its host and drops to the ground, it will molt into the adult breeding stage. Adults are active during the cooler months when temperatures are 50 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. Like the nymph, adults also climb higher on plants to attach to larger hosts. After feeding for several days, adult deer ticks fall from their hosts, find each other, and mate. The females lay their eggs in the spring and then die. Personal precautions against tick bites remain the best means of reducing the risk of contracting Lyme disease. When hiking in the woods, wear light-colored clothes so that ticks are easier to see and remove. To prevent ticks from getting on your skin, wear long pants tucked into your socks or sealed to boot tops with tape, and wear a long-sleeve shirt tucked into your pants. There are two types of tick repellent to keep you safe. Repellent containing permethrin can be applied to clothing. Repellent containing DEET can be applied to skin. Always follow label directions. During and after your hike, conduct frequent tick checks and remove them immediately. Research indicates that a tick must be attached and feeding for 36 hours before disease transmission occurs. If a tick bite occurs, remove it with sharply pointed tweezers by grasping the tick as close to the skin as possible and pull steadily until the tick is removed. If part of the tick is left in the skin, remove it and treat the bite with antiseptic. If you are bitten by a tick carrying Lyme disease, the most common sign is an expanding rash at the site of the tick bite. The rash generally has a reddish edge with a more normal colored skin in the center. Other early symptoms feel like the flu, such as headache, mild fever and body aches, and fatigue. The rash and symptoms usually develop within 1 month of the tick bite. To learn more about tick and Lyme disease prevention, please visit our website. Don't let ticks deter you from enjoying the many benefits that come from hiking on forest trails, such as the Millstream Trail in Centerville. Until next time, I hope this story inspires you to explore and learn more about Delmarva's many natural wonders.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.